Engle, in order to understand the strengths and weaknesses of the new savage threat, would reveal that over 300 savages were killed in that pass. The AGM-98 system's AI targeted and spent at least 50 high-velocity blasts on each target in a sudden blur of fire. It was so much fire that it even slowed the Valkyrie's approach, which in turn only allowed the targeting AI to be even more thorough in its lethal work. A moment later, it was gone, and so was the sound of gunfire from the savage lines. The colonel scrambled forward across the bodies inside the barrier. He reached Maydoun's body and pulled him over onto his back, hoping there was some treatable wound that meant the kid was still alive, or at least had the chance to go on living. But it wasn't a body. It was a live young LT with no visible damage. The headless infantryman, whoever he was, had saved his platoon one last time. Chapter 9. Dawn broke as the colonel made his way back into the stadium. The once pristine sports complex, the jewel of the galaxy even just a few years back, looked now like a post-apocalyptic ruin from some destabilized colony world. Or a movie set. The 3-6 Cavs drone recon detachment was sending back reports that the savage assault that had begun in the last half hour had broken. The streets surrounding the stadium were mostly clear, and it looked like some of the larger enemy concentrations were pulling back under the cover of the massive savage ship located near Hilltop. The jaw-droppingly massive mech that had been spotted coming down the hill toward the park had fired 3 barrages against the stadium before coalition bombers off the Indomitable, flanked by interceptors, had made a decisive run and knocked it out. This streak of good news was immediately dampened by casualty reports. The disconnected units that had been dropped almost willy-nilly by the supercarrier all across the battlefield were hurting. To make matters worse, the Supreme Coalition Commander, appointed as overall leader for this action, had ordered all units to hunker in place for the next 2 hours until he could assess the situation now that he was on the ground. "He should pull them back to the stadium," muttered Marks after the operations briefing over the comnet had ended. "Makes sense to me, sir," said SGM Andres. "But the big dog says we got to hold on to what we got, like General Ogilvy thinks we got lucky and gained ground with that 8-up drop going bad like it did and all." The colonel pounded a coffee someone had handed him and studied his battle board. "He just doesn't want to admit he was wrong," he muttered to himself, though the sergeant major and everyone else nearby heard him just the same. The colonel almost added something else, thought better of it, and drank more coffee instead. For the next hour, he and the sergeant major checked the lines of their unit, making sure the surviving command teams were linked up with the units on their flanks. At Delta once again, which was verging on total ruin with now less than 25% of its original troops, the sergeant major remarked, "They're going to put us on guard duty in the rear, sir, once they get a look at our numbers." This made the colonel none too happy. Another hour later, they arrived at the Ad Hoc Combat Information Center, set up on the troop deck of the Porter. What had started out as a grand operation to deal with the new, oddly concentrated savage problem was now looking to the colonel like an absolute and utter failure, and the situation was getting worse by the second.
"Everything is going according to plan,"
announced Ogilvy to a collection of commanders and staff officers. General Ogilvy, Supreme Commander of Coalition Forces.
"It may look dire," he continued, shaking his head slightly, but not enough to dislodge a strand of his well-manicured iron-gray hair. "But we couldn't have asked for a better drop on the board. Some of our units have established forward operating spheres within direct striking distance of the savage nest. I'm green-lighting offensive."
He paused as he noticed Colonel Marks and SGM Andres covered in dust and dried blood, without proper chest armor, carrying rifles inside the TOC, which had been expressly forbidden by executive correction to the coalition SOP.
"Operations immediately," finished the general. Then, on a droll note of disapproval, "Colonel Marks, so very glad you could join us. I'll chalk up your heavy casualties to your last-minute appointment of command to your unit. Still, all things considered, you did a commendable job holding the primary insertion point. Though it would seem that we no longer need Objective Rio as a staging base now that we're switching over to the offensive in, he murmured to an aide. The aide murmured quietly back after consulting one of three battle boards he was carrying. Just under 2 hours, finished the general, as though some expectedly delightful party would commence round about that time, instead of the bloodbath and death that would reach industrialized proportions. The colonel cleared his throat, only because it was dry. As I was saying, continued the general, having registered his quiet disapproval with the colonel's late arrival to his sacred briefing hour in the way he kept looking the man up and down, because most of our lead infantry units jumped first and centered around the original markers, we have a unique opportunity, he said this brightly, to form an assault force that will pass through our support units, which are now the most forwarding operating elements, and form a combined arms assault team as we drive in on the enemy nest and destroy it forthwithly. Again, the colonel cleared his dry throat. This irritated General Ogilvy for a brief second, but his calm, cool, savvy player's professionalism quickly covered. He sensed an opportunity to assert total control over the coalition of factionalized world militaries who'd been distributed to him in an almost pell-mell fashion to deal with the savage threat once and for all. Pulling this off was sure to put him in good standing to run for United World's prime minister in the next election, 2 years from now. And then, who knew? Some factions were talking about forming a galactic confederacy of all the human worlds. Was it too much that he dared to dream of being the first leader of such an assembly? Something wrong, Colonel? He asked, fixing Marx with a look of cool, contemptuous appraisal from his perfect blue eyes. The colonel smiled, and it seemed a thing he was not necessarily given to or much practiced at. Then he walked forward through the press of career officers gathering about the task force's supreme commander. Some of the officers looked rather put out at having to make room for this nobody colonel who'd only just been attached to the strike force at the last second. "Well, sir," began the colonel. He didn't bother to add the customary, "no disrespect intended." "If the savages push, most of those units located nearest the colony ship are not suited for combat operations, specifically CQB. He moved toward the tactical display and indicated the forwardmost unit. "This is the 93rd Artillery out of Hayes's world, firing 140mm counter battery fire. Or here." He swept his hand, dirty and bloodstained, toward another flanking unit resting under the digital shadow of the massive Leviathan he'd called the colony ship, even though Operations SOP had made sure to specifically refer to it as the Nest. Like it was just a bunch of insects that needed clearing out before the city could return to normal commerce and operation. "Nothing more. Sorry about the inconvenience of a horde of post-human monsters descending on you en masse with who knew what technological voodoo they'd cooked up in their long haul through the stellar darkness to download on the unsuspecting citizens of this world. And, of course, that was always the question. What had they cooked up this time?" "This," continued the colonel, "is a UW heavy armor regiment. If the savages come at us again, they won't have infantry support for more than 2 hours, according to your timetables, sir." No one missed the amount of cold disgust with which the upstart intruder colonel had used the word timetables. Now it was the supreme commander's turn to clear his throat. "I'm sorry, Colonel." He wasn't. "But the savages have obviously seen our initial display of force and are on the run. Hardly the first time they've fled before our might. I wouldn't be half surprised if they didn't back up into their little ship and scoot off altogether. So far," he murmured once more to the aide. The aide murmured back, "we have no active units engaged, and drone recon analysis indicates zero enemy contact on the field at this time. They've either fallen back completely to the nest, or they've gone underground, in which case we can gas the tunnels and deal with them more than effectively in that manner." "Excuse me, sir," said one of the staff officers, a small, unassuming man, Major Musashi. He was running intel for the entire operation, attached from the Sanasian world's defense forces. We're 90% sure that the new Vega populace is sheltering in the subway system. From the early days of the colony, it was specifically designed to be used as an emergency bunker system. Respectfully, sir, gassing the subways will result in tens of thousands of civilian casualties. This took the Supreme Commander back a bit, enough so that it may have been evident in his expression to the other men in the room. Mark certainly saw it. Any hope Ogilvy had of being a galactic leader would be torpedoed in light of a genocide of his own making. Yes, he thought to himself, genocide must be avoided at all costs, if only for the sake of his political aspirations. Thank you, Major. That option must be taken off the table, he announced, as though he alone were the voice of reason restraining them from their eager push for results, despite pesky mass civilian casualties. Our primary objective is to rescue the civilian populace. If we do nothing else here, then we must do that. There. That sounded like a quote someone might put on a statue, in light of how well everything was certain to go. But the point will be moot once we've eradicated the nest. We obviously have superior forces, continued Ogilvy, finding his tenor and feet once more. And once we've breached the old colony ship, the nest, we can certainly expect enemy forces on the ground to go into a defensive posture if standard savage hierarchical philosophy kicks in like we know it will. Then, why, for all intents and purposes, they'll just clean themselves out of the sewers and subways attempting to save the ship. As I've stated previously in my papers on this subject, once they feel threatened, it's wheels up for them, and they'll clear off. And if the Navy... Supreme Coalition Commander Ogilvy nodded to the Navy Admiral and his small support staff attending the briefing. If the Navy arrives on station at the appropriate moment, once the ship lifts off and she's fat and slow in low atmo, well then, the game will certainly change, won't it, lads? Lads. Lads, thought the Colonel, like this is some weekend Volks hunting party on Britannia Centauri. Lads. You're going to get everyone killed, muttered the Colonel through gritted teeth. Several career-minded officers immediately expressed their disgust at such an insubordinate outburst. Excuse me, began Supreme Commander Ogilvy, going florid. Just who the hell do you think you are exactly, Colonel? Mark squared his shoulders and faced his superior. Ahem. The impending stare down was interrupted by the Navy Admiral, a man named Sulla, who wore the midnight blue dress trench of the United Worlds Navy. I'd like to invoke the commitment clause established by our respective governments. Clearly, this spat is interplanetary, Earth and Spilerza, and it needs to be tabled. Time is of the essence. If we miss putting the cap over the battle space and that ship reaches jump, we won't get another shot at this particular group of savages until they reemerge at a time of their own choosing, causing the same chaos we see before us today. That some savages have implemented jump technology is undisputed, but that's hardly confirmed with this batch, Ogilvy said, not removing his gaze from the subordinate colonel. And if they're without it, we'll easily chase them down, even if they do manage to lift off planet. That's true, Commander, said the Admiral. And until we get in and crack the local sensor data net, we can't be sure what their capabilities are. But that ship came in fast, without warning, and set down before the local military could respond, even before the government could get off a boosted message to her local allies. If not for a damn free trader captain and her crew, who barely got out of here alive, we might not even have known the savages were here. So I can't say for certain they have jump capability, but I'm not prepared to bet against the possibility, sir. Admiral Sulla knew he had delved farther into the details than was called for, a tendency of his of late. But of course all that was an act. He had achieved his purpose, getting the meeting back on track and taking fire off of Colonel Marks. Ogilvy swept away Sulla's comments. Regardless of their capability, you are correct about one thing. According to regulations, we need to stay on mission. Though, He fixed Marks with a steely glare. I will certainly be pursuing this matter with the arbitrating coalition body at a later time. He regained his confident, almost haughty bearing. I am well aware that our assets aren't picture perfect on the field as of this moment. Once operations commence, and we get our Marines, Centauri Crusaders, and the other infantry units attached to the strike force forward and up in front of the support units, then our positioning will be correct for a final assault on the nest.
The general turned and murmured once more to his aide-de-camp. The aide did not murmur, and instead set up the tactical display to show Phase 2 of Operation Warhammer.
As you can see, we cross the line of departure here and pick up the flanking support units. By the time we form our line of advance, we'll still be at least 4 kilometers from the identified nest entry point Takan has targeted for breach. While we can't gas the subways, a thing I simply will not condone, we can, of course, nerve gas the nest once we set up a control perimeter here.
He pointed with an actual riding crop at the digital schematic of the Savage Colony ship. Halfway up the rising district of Hilltop, along a narrow street lined with half-crushed buildings, an outer deck hangar had opened up. Colonel Marks was about to speak up again, but Admiral Sulla caught his eye and gave a fractional shake of his head. No one noticed what passed between them. They were all staring at the nest. The colony ship, the Hulk, was truly a relic out of the past. An ancient lighthugger 40 decks high at least. It should have burned up in some celestial miscalculation, or come apart in the gravitic tides of one of the supergas giants of some undiscovered system it wandered into years ago, or settled into decay on some lost planet out toward the galaxy's edge. It had no place here, and yet here it had arrived, a threat to the human hyperspace colonies, established while it lurched through the outer darkness. And whenever these abortions showed up, there were, historically and inevitably, only 2 possible outcomes. Either the planetary defenses destroyed the Hulks and their post-human inhabitants, or the savages killed every person in the colony before moving on. Total kill, one way or another.
Chapter 10. When the meeting broke up and commanders who'd be working together began to interface, the admiral drifted away from his staff who were busy coordinating naval support for the upcoming operation. He crossed through the crowd in the tactical operations center aboard the troop hangar of the Porter toward Colonel Marks. The colonel saw him coming and said something to Sergeant Major Andres. The sergeant major nodded and moved off, probably to interface with the supply chains aboard the Porter. Now that the Montague could no longer resupply the 25th, they'd need to dip into the Porter's combat stores. Charge packs for the standard M73 automatic pulse rifle were chief among the most critical of needs, if the barely combat-effective unit were to remain operational. Otherwise, they'd be using sidearms, demo packs, and snide remarks. Never a good combination.
"Colonel Marks," said Admiral Sulla formally, glancing from side to side.
"Admiral," muttered the colonel.
"Okay. You've said your little piece. I know this looks bad, but you've got to give this a chance. Can't do it the old way."
The colonel said nothing. "He's an idiot. I get that. But the coalition couldn't form unless they picked the least threatening and least capable person they could find to lead this. They didn't want another Warren turning absolute dictator. So, he's an idiot, but he's our idiot, colonel."
Marks took a deep breath and continued to stare at the admiral. His eyes were cold, casual murder. But Sulla considered this to be their normal state, more or less. And sometimes he wondered if it was he, Sulla, who'd known the man the longest, who was the only one to see that cold, casual murder. Wondered if all the rest of the galaxy saw was just a normal, early middle-aged man, compact, trim, and fit. All business, no mirth. Military. He wondered if that was all they saw. And how could there ever be mirth, having seen what he's seen, thought Sulla, having done what he's done? How?
"I am doing it your way," the colonel muttered.
but it sure as hell doesn't seem like anything other than the same old, same old. And a lot of these kids are going to get killed today. You and I both know if the savages get a stranglehold on a world, they'll spread like a virus. We're running out of worlds, Sulla caught himself. His voice had been more forceful, more insistent than he'd wanted it to be. He smoothed his coat and finished without saying what he was going to say. There was a long silence. Some of the other officers from the breaking-up meeting may have glanced over as the exchange got a little intense, or so it seemed. The colonel leaned forward and spoke in a low voice. This world is already dead. They, he said, indicating with a terse nod the staff officers of the Supreme Coalition Commander, just don't know it yet. And then a hubbub that had been rising over near sensors and acquisition grew in volume. Officers were picking up their gear and running for the cargo door of the porter, running for their waiting units spread out beneath the hilltop district. Chapter 11 3-6 Cav, 26th and Park. For all intents and purposes, Sergeant Greenhill was in command of 4th Platoon, Charlie Company, 3rd Battalion, 6th Troop. The element Colonel Dipple had selected for the recon and forced to place the drop markers. The company XO was now the commanding officer. After handling the wounded, there weren't many. Most had died. And getting a blue sky report, they'd been ordered to hunker in place at the bottom of the long sloping park that led up to the hilltop district. It was a perfect golden morning, with clouds off to the east. In the distance, up the slope, the behemoth walking mech that had come out from the savage nest was still burning, sending up oily plumes of dark smoke to drift off to the west. Look at that! Someone shouted from farther back along the convoy, parked in the shade of a silent office tower. Greenhill had ordered everyone to watch their sectors and to stay vigilant, and to stay inside the MTAVs in case the need to roll out on a react fast came down from higher up. They were fast attack all the way. Or so they barked out each time they saluted a superior officer. Someone had been watching the sky. To the south, where the bizarre old dinosaur of a savage hulk wallowed beside the glittering jewel hilltop neighborhood that had once been New Vegas' boast to the galaxy, the air around the massive ship was beginning to shimmer and sparkle all along its flat, dirty white exterior. Greenhill grabbed his Nox from off his chest plate and dialed in on the enigmatic ship. His mouth dropped open. It's a damn drone strike. He touched the comm on the side of his helmet and got a message off to the fleet CIC, alerting them of a possible inbound drone strike. Then he turned to his men. Seal up the vehicles and switch the mounted guns over to internal remote right now. Mere seconds later, vicious bat-shaped drones, ceramic white on their tops and shimmering polished metal underneath, slammed into the convoy and filled the skies around the city streets with great dark swarms. Windows smashed. The automated guns dialed up and engaged the drones as they came whipping down the street, firing small bursts of low-caliber ammunition. Sudden violent sprays of lead smashed into the armored vehicles. The savage drone fire was ineffective. The MTAVs had been designed for conflicts out along the Spallersan frontier, where many of the local indigenous races, like the violent Wabanki, possessed antiquated firearms as their highest military tech. But then the drones began to smash directly into the MTAVs and explode. That was where most of the damage was done. Three vehicles cooked off within the first minute. Through the smashed safety glass of his MTAV's front windshield, Greenhill tried to observe what the drones were doing. Those that weren't smashing into vehicles were circling, as though waiting their turn to exploit some vulnerability. And, thought Greenhill to himself, who'd been in a drone strike during the brief Spallersa-Hispania conflict over Tezacan, they're acquiring more data for a better strike. The MTAV, Greenhill knew, had one design flaw. It carried external munitions cases along its rear panels. The containers were bulletproof and blasterproof and could be deployed outward like shields for the infantry to cover behind when dismounted. But the end of one side of the large box had been left unarmored for some enigmatic design reason. A hit on this panel would cook off all the munitions within, volatile charge packs and demo packs together. Worse,
The vehicle's fuel cells were close by, under the thinly armored skin in this section. They were protected from below in case of mines, which meant the resulting explosion was a shape detonation that blew through the troop compartment to the rear of the vehicle, usually killing everyone. Greenhill had seen it happen before.
"They're trying to figure it out and all,"
he muttered to himself, and then, as if on cue, one drone streaked away from its holding pattern and whipped straight in at Sergeant Beecham's vehicle. Flying debris and fire went in all directions. Greenhill watched as the driver, the guy with the only chance of escaping a cook-off, struggled from the vehicle without his weapon. His fatigues were on fire in a few places, but he could have rolled on the ground and put those out once he got the mind to stop running. The driver managed 5 steps before another drone, maybe 0.5 meter across and 1 meter long, slammed straight through his back and came out the front of his chest, dragging his heart and spine out onto the street before fluttering away.
"All vehicles," roared Greenhill into the comm. "We are exiting the AO. Follow me."
"Where are we going, Sarge?" asked Kurtz.
"Gun it now, Private."
Kurtz didn't hesitate, and a second later, the MTAV was racing away from the park. 0.5 block down, Greenhill told the driver to cut hard for a narrow side street. The top-heavy MTAV went up on 3 of its 6 ceramic wheels and barely threaded the narrow alley. Greenhill switched on the vehicle's rear camera and tried to make out how much of the unit was following.
He could see 3 other MTAVs before his view was blocked by the rest of the platoon. "Kill it," he shouted.
The MTAV idled in place as more of the platoon followed inside the alley. The high buildings on either side would provide a sort of baffle against the drones, forcing them to fly in from fixed entry points, if they pursued at all.
"This can't be it, can it?"
Greenhill asked his driver.
"Looks like everyone's dead or hunkered inside the alley," answered Kurtz. "At least in here, them drones can't maneuver well."
That was true enough. Hitting the right panel would be much more difficult.
3-6, command announced over the comm. "Proceed 3 blocks west. The 931st artillery needs an assist." "Here we go,"
Greenhill muttered, resisting the urge to shake his head. Kurtz was staring at him like he hoped the sergeant would tell him they were staying put in the alley. But that's not what you did when your brothers needed help.
"You heard him, Kurtz. Let's roll."
Chapter 12. Colonel Marks linked up with his sergeant major once the impromptu meeting with Admiral Sulla came to an end. The sergeant major's face told Marks that things had gone to hell, all without saying a word.
"Details,"
Marks ordered.
"It was an anti-personnel strike, sir," replied Andres.
"We got mass casualties in Charlie and Bravo. Delta was almost no good after the landing, so that leaves us with most of headquarters. Here's what we show from the feeds."
Colonel Marks watched as images of the drones came in quickly, swarming away from the old colony ship and striking as many of the exposed as they could find. Those in vehicles or undercover had survived for the most part, but those in the open had been torn to pieces by the high-speed deadly drones. The colonel looked at his unit roster display. The battle board's readouts showed him a lot of needless waste, a lot of dead who'd never needed to die in the first place so that a bad plan could be tested. He nodded to himself. He would let them go as far as they could, but he'd brought something along to make sure the job got done in the end.
"We still go to hit the LOD in 30 minutes, sir?" Andres asked.
Mark set his jaw. That idiot Ogilvy still wanted everyone to cross the line of departure in 30 minutes. But that wasn't something he could communicate down the chain of command.
"Affirmative, Sergeant Major," said Marks.
"And we're on foot, right?" asked the Sergeant Major, like that was the worst idea in the world after what had just happened. "No crawlers."
"Roger that.
We pick up a company of Hispanian sentinels and follow the right flank in."
"Well," said Andres slowly, thinking things over, "I don't like it, sir. I mean, having them big old sentinels and their main guns is nice if we meet some more armor. But another drone strike and we got to go for cover real quick-like. That's fine and all if we in the city itself. But if we get caught out in the open, we're going to lose a lot of my boys."
"I agree, Sergeant Major," said the colonel. "So we'll do our best to stick near cover as we move.
I need you to cannibalize the surviving companies. Move everyone into a new combat team I'm setting up now. Should be on your screen.
Andres tapped through some screens slowly. Tech was not his strong point.
This it, sir? Strike Team Ranger?
Affirmative, Sergeant Major. That'll be our designator going forward.
Chapter 13. 3-6 Armored Cavalry, Fast Attack, 22nd Street and Zonda Road. What remained of the 931st Artillery wasn't much. Most of the guns had been disabled during the savage drone strike. The 3-6 Cav, in convoy now with 7 vehicles left from the original recon force, rolled up on what had been the 931st's established perimeter around a grand fountain at a massive intersection just outside the downtown financial district. After the bad drop, the 931st's commander had ordered the unit to deploy its massive counter-battery guns until the next bug-out. The gun bunnies, Sergeant Greenhill's term for artillerymen, had deployed the automated guns and set up the command interface fire request network. A few sentries were dispatched in teams to set up defensive heavy machine gun positions guarding the access points into the main square, where the massive guns were slowly unfolding skyward. When the drone swarm swept through the streets, it slaughtered the sentries in one pass. Seconds later, the teams setting up the main guns were similarly dispatched. And then the drones, having identified the military equipment, set about to ramming themselves into the guns in order to disable the field pieces. As they slammed their ceramic explosive-laden bodies into the fire control comps, they knocked out some of the big guns. Barrel strikes didn't bother the behemoths in the least, but the destroyed targeting computers effectively killed the weapons, operationally speaking. Once the remains of the Cav troops showed up, Greenhill ordered a dismount and a check for survivors, though he didn't have high hopes. This once ordinary intersection, typical of many such in all the colony worlds, was littered with dead bodies. At the center of all the carnage was the fountain that commemorated the colony's founding. A small stone ship rose from the hands of various long-dead people who seemed to hold it upward toward the stars. If the city's water and power had been on, the fountaining jets of water would have looked like exhaust thrust. Or something along those lines, thought Greenhill absently as he stared at all the death and waste and tried to figure out where to begin. His job as a Cav scout was to find the enemy so that the enemy could be destroyed, not find his own dead people.
"Schoolhouse, this is 4-1,
he said once he dialed into the CIC Intel comm channel.
"We got total unit kill on the 391, guns most likely ineffective."
Then, from over near one of the big guns, one of the Cav troopers shouted,
"We got one!"
Apparently someone had survived. Chapter 14. Team Ranger, crossing the line of departure. The colonel was forward with the lead elements of the new team, and Sergeant Major Andres was at the rear. The surviving infantrymen of the 25th had formed into two columns on opposite sides of the roadway they'd been assigned as their lane for the coming assault into the savage-held portions of the city. New elements, platoons, fire teams, and special teams had been broken down and filled. Team Ranger was slightly under company strength, but it was heavily armed, carrying as much as the men could manage, loaded for bear. Marks gave one order over the comm before they crossed the line of departure to shoot, move, and communicate as a team. Kill everything in their way with extreme and maximum violence and protect the massive Espanian Sentinel tanks they would pick up 10 blocks forward. The route through the business district, along the main body of Strike Force Warhammer's right flank, would take them into an industrialized neighborhood called the Hops, where the Espanian armor had been dropped by a heavy lifter squadron. That armor wouldn't move until it had infantry support, so of course Ogilvy had sent the disrespectful Colonel Marks off to shepherd the armor into the game. Fine, the colonel had thought. What he really wanted to do was turn the whole place into a glass parking lot, but in lieu of that, the Espanian armor could do a lot of damage if it was left in peace to operate. His infantry could provide that service. Sir, said Maydoun, the LT from Delta who'd held the Ford position and was now acting as the colonel's executive officer. Marks had selected the kid because he was the most professional officer the colonel had met since taking charge of the unit, and because there was every chance Marks himself was going to get killed advancing against the colony ship. If so, well, this kid was a killer and a capable leader, and maybe he'd get the job done instead. Getting the job done was all the colonel cared about, and that job was killing savages, regardless of what the politicians said.
Yes, Lieutenant?
I'm talking with the Air Boss team, and we're low on priority for tasking. The colonel gave him an enigmatic look.
Maydoun didn't miss a beat. I just wanted to make that clear in case we get into something. We probably shouldn't expect artillery support.
Good to know, said the colonel, because we are going to get into something, trust me on that.
The next 10 blocks were hot and silent. They passed no dead civilians, a few wrecked pieces of drone, and crossed a lot of hot streets. The savage artillery had fallen occasionally, decimating whole buildings and laying waste to blocks. The late morning air was warm, muggy, and incredibly still, like it was waiting for something. Wallowing black smoke was still drifting out and off to the west of the enormous mech, in the distant foreground of the enemy hulk. Apart from that, the city was a graveyard. The colonel kept his eyes forward and moved along the street just behind a two-man point team 30 meters ahead of the main column. The heavily armed infantry to his rear were spoiling for a fight, or complaining about the heat, or watching the shadows nervously. Everyone burned off the fear of an approaching fight in their own specific way. And whereas the colonel had been a hard charger since taking command of the unit in the hours before the operation began, he let this slide and ignored their jokes, chatter, and nervous silence. They would need to get themselves ready for what was coming, and it was too late to teach them anything else. He called a halt after an hour. Sergeant Major Andres set out a comm for everyone to get off the street and swap out their socks. It would be a long day and a lot of walking. Many of them, according to him, probably hadn't changed their socks since they left Spilurza Naval Weapons Station on Omeron. The colonel found himself with the primary assault team. Riflemen, overloaded with fraggers and flashbang bandoliers to pin down the enemy and give the heavy weapons teams time to set up and lock in some support fire. All of them were sitting in the darkness of the clothing store they designated for cover during the halt, leaning against the walls, except the platoon sergeant, who was watching from the shattered doorway. It was silent, hot, and still among the clothes the store had offered in the days before the savage invasion, 6 weeks ago. The colonel sat down and dutifully changed his socks. Leadership began at the top, and though he might be in charge, it was the sergeant major who really ran things, and so everyone needed to see him, the colonel, obeying the orders of the toppest of cats. Change your socks.
One of the assault team members muttered in the darkness. Should have done the whole planet with an orbital strike or one of them trigger nukes. I'm way too short to buy it on this rock.
A few of the others laughed. It was always the guys whose enlistment was up soon that got worried the most. That was as old as time itself.
Yeah, for a war criminal, said one of the other soldiers. Tyrus Rex sure does know how to do things upright.
War criminal, said another. Who says? Spilurza ain't part of that little confederacy, and they got no power to go around deciding for the rest of us how things got to be done proper. Hell, hand me a few dozen trigger nukes and I'd do this hellhole myself right now and wouldn't bat an eye. Biggs is right. I'm too short to get killed today. I've been saving up for a scout ship. Was going to get myself my own planet out along the edge.
You can't even fly, Daz. You'll end up in a sun somewhere or cooked by the Z. They all up and over those worlds out there along the edge.
The rest laughed at Daz until the platoon sergeant told them to shut the damn hell up and get your gear tight.
I'll learn, Daz promised them in a whisper.
And then the halt was over and they were on the march again. They had a date. And destiny didn't like to be kept waiting. Neither did death.
A few tense and quiet blocks later, they linked up with the command team for the 1st Royal Hispanian Armor. Captain Alvarez de Macha was a tall, lanky man who used long strides to cover lots of ground. He wore armor and a helmet and carried the standard TS-85 blaster, subcompact variant for tankers, on a sling around his chest. Colonel Marks was heartened by what he saw. The man didn't rely on his massive tank to protect him. He didn't take chances, and he moved quickly in a businesslike manner. If any of them were to survive the next few hours, excellent skills and good habits might make the difference. Or at least, that had been the colonel's experience in the dozen or more wars he'd fought in. He'd lost count of the individual battles a long time ago. "We are 5 sentinels," announced Captain de Macha in accented standard, a language once known as English on old Earth. On a Spaniard, they spoke a mix of old Romance languages that had all eventually succumbed to a Spanish variant, but de Macha seemed to know his standard well. It was the language of the galaxy. "Our weak point is our flanking armor and weapon arcs. I try to keep the men good with the coax machine gun on top of my beasts, but they often put too much, how do you say, faith in the forward armor and the very mighty main gun. That is where we are, muy mejor, the best." "Good," said Marks. They had come inside the perimeter of the tanks, and now Team Ranger was breaking down to assist each tank with protection along the flanks and rear. "We'll keep a point team forward and to the right of each tank. Please tell your men not to fire unless my troops have a heads up from your track commanders. Just have the TC identify and state engaging forward over the general comm. That should get them down and covered. The rest will trail the tank and react to any fire or attacks from the flanks." The commander flipped out his battle board, making it suddenly 3 fully integrated screens, and pointed. "Command wants us to follow this road right off the main body. That should put us up on hilltop where we can provide cover and overwatch once the main assault begins on the objective. The ancient savage colony ship, the ship the philosophers who'd set up this mission to save New Vega from an apocalyptic solution had called the Nest, had been tagged here as Objective Black Widow.
Chapter 15. 4 streets farther south, they met their 1st refugees coming out of an industrial warehouse along the street. Under heavy guard, the refugee leader, a man who identified himself as John Carstairs, a doctor with the University Hospital at New Vega, was allowed through to meet with Colonel Marks and Captain de Macha. One of the medics came forward to give him water and check him over. The rest of the men watched him and the other refugees suspiciously.
"It's been horrible," said the trembling man. "A living nightmare since the dreams began."
His eyes were haunted and far away. He was still under guard, as were the 30-odd refugees huddled under the watchful barrel of the main gun of the lead sentinel. The colonel had heard Captain de Macha order his gunner to burn them with a Spitfire round if anyone made a false move. Reports of refugees exploding or attacking the strike force during the 1st engagements after the carrier drop had circulated enough that Ogilvy had issued a directive toward vigilance when handling refugees. Marks had been in the Tactical Operations Center and had seen how much duress the man had needed to be put under, protesting about the optics for his troops to remain safe. The deciding factor came when one of Ogilvy's staff officers assured him that needless casualties would play as badly in the media as dead refugees, and that higher casualty reports might result in subscribing members of the Confederacy backing out if their troops unduly bore the brunt of such suicide assaults. And that would be his, Supreme Coalition Commander Ogilvy's, fault. So he'd reluctantly issued the directive.
"We knew something was up at the hospital the first night over 7 weeks ago," continued the haggard doctor as he gulped at the water in the canteen he'd been given. "Sure, it was a full moon, always crazy, but the usual reports of bizarre behavior were off the charts. Within hours, our predictive data algorithms identified that a vast majority of our cases involve law enforcement and government personnel. That didn't make any sense. We had a council member come in hallucinating and in full tachycardia. She attacked 2 security guards and killed them both with her bare hands.
Say again, said Marks.
The doctor nodded in a tired, haunted manner, like dwelling on the memory fatigued him.
90-pound woman. Then she just stroked out. Wasn't right, and at first I suspected some kind of virus.
But no longer, asked the matcher.
I'm pretty sure, now that I've had time to think about all this while we've been hiding, that they were using some kind of targeted nanovirus keyed for specific DNA. The savages, I mean. And you know what that means.
Neither the colonel nor Captain DeMacha knew what that meant.
Enlighten us, said Marks. But the wild-eyed doctor seemed not to hear him and just continued moving his head up and down erratically as though confirming something he'd been so sure of all along and still felt responsible for nonetheless. His voice shook as he started backing up.
They were here for weeks, possibly months even, before the ship came in. And they were quiet as a mouse sneaking around and up to no good. Quiet as a mouse. They hacked our DNA and made archives.
We keep files and samples for every citizen. State-of-the-art processing and archive center down in the old colony.
Somehow they got in there, hacked the databanks, pulled out physical samples, and had enough time to spin up targeted nanoviruses on our leading command and control systems. That first wave was here for maybe at least 2 weeks before everything began going to hell.
He drank more water.
The colonel used that as an opportunity to change the subject and see what other intel the obviously fractured man might be able to provide.
We've had reports of compromised citizens attacking the strike force, being used as IEDs. What can you tell us about that?
Captain DeMacha didn't even blink when the colonel failed to use the proper coalition term, rescue force. Instead, he added,
And how can we be sure your group isn't also compromised?
The ragged doctor nodded emphatically and guzzled more water, sloshing it across his scraggly beard.
Red striations, like a rash all over the neck. We identified that early on, and the only cure was to quarantine your own group. Not quarantines for the sick. Quarantines for the healthy. Keep the good shut away from the bad. It was the only way you knew people weren't infected, so you could trust them.
This illness is what causes people exploding? Asked Captain DeMacha.
Yes, in the sense that it makes them willing to do it. The red striations are the result of some kind of neural control toxin, something they were injected with before the surgery.
Surgery?
Yes, said the doctor, moving from desperate survivor to clinician, calmer now as he turned toward the business he understood, the interface of medicine and survival. Infected survivors exhibiting the striations would attempt to infiltrate other survivor groups. The savages at first were trying to get down into the bunkers along the subway and into Old Colony itself. More than a few episodes of self-detonation, not always explosive, mind you. There were reports of nerve gas and other chemical agents as well, but these patterns were nonetheless identified by the survivor network using the emergency survival protocols we've trained for our whole lives, and we developed a response.
What was it? Asked Marks, eager for any insight into this particular band of savages.
Simply put, we cut ourselves off from each other. The most dangerous part, I suspect, right now, is that as the refugee groups are leaving their bunkers, coming out to be rescued by you, these lone bombers, that's what we've been calling them, will attempt to mix in and detonate within your ranks. Expect it.
DeMacha whistled and swore. The medic had given the doctor a low-dose sedative, and he was growing calmer by the second, even appraising, as though only just now fully appreciating the grand perspective of the hell he'd just lived through.
I'll tell you this, he said, watching something off in the distance that no one else could see.
Something only he saw, because it only existed in his mind and memory.
Marks had seen that look thousands of times before. It speaks to the savage ruthlessness that they devised such a cunning strategy. It was almost as if they knew you'd respond in force,
and they wanted to be inserted among us or even posing as a whole group of refugees. So, that when the time came, when you showed up, as it were, they'd disable your ground forces by masquerading as the most desperate of us. He frowned. I am, or rather I was, a student of history, old Earth history. I don't think I ever will be again. I couldn't possibly be after this nightmare from our past suddenly showed up on our doorstep and ruined everything we've built, but I was. And what the savages are employing, the IED trick, it's timeless. It still turns up occasionally in our modern conflicts, but back on Earth, before the big uplift, before the Great Leap, it was very common in dealing with superior numbers and an overwhelming technological advantage held by the enemy force, especially among the fundamentalist radical types, ideologues.
Nothing new under the sun, Mark said, rubbing his face.
He hoped the doctor had something more useful than fourth-rate military history to chatter about. The doctor nodded. What this tells me about this particular brand of savages, and I know this is shockingly naive, you types are all briefed in their behavior mechanisms and patterns, but this tactic, this is like a window into their soul, which is really a window into our souls, as it were. The savages are who we were before the advent of the hyperdrive, before the colonies and the new empires. We are getting a look back at ourselves, how we used to behave. And it's absolutely barbaric. Turning other humans into bombs to blow up your enemy where he's weakest, where he's giving aid and mercy to the desperate. Terror campaigns.
Marx didn't have the heart to tell the trembling academic just how nasty war was out on the fringes, far away from formerly safe and civilized worlds like New Vega.
When your men get wind of this, the doctor continued, the terror will spread just as it did then. And suppose this invasion is a sign of what's still to come. What do we know of the savages, really? Their numbers, their abilities, their coordination. Suppose we see more of this and the panic grows, and the worlds we call home catch fire in a frenzy of terrorized angst, and all the other fractures are revealed. One bombing in some high-end restaurant could be all it takes to make an empire capitulate to the savages. It's happened before, to us. This was us. They were once us. That's who we are facing out here. Except now, they're post-human. And what exactly does that mean?
No one said anything.
Can you tell me?
Asked the doctor. But no one could. So no one answered. The doctor shook his head rapidly, as if clearing it of all the thinking he'd done during the 6 weeks of stark raving hell since the survivors had bunkered.
There's one other thing. Their strategy, capturing strays, pumping them full of neuro-controlled toxin, and then performing a bomb-installed surgery. It hurts them, too.
How so?
Asked the colonel. He always keyed in on ways to hurt the savages.
Why, they're cannibals now. Haven't you noticed? They're needlessly wasting calories just to terrorize us. Look around. This city had a population of 10 million. Do you see any corpses in the streets?
Chapter 16. The Wild Man. 32nd floor, Cyrus Gardens Luxury Apartments, Hilltop District. He'd come to hunt. Hunt savages. 6 weeks after the infection, invasion, call it what you will, when all the planets of the not-even-yet-formed confederacy, sometimes it called itself a coalition, had put out the general warning to avoid New Vega at all costs, possible savage outbreak in the stellar region, he'd arrived. Why, he'd headed straight for it. The only option for a lone traveler was to find an old scout ship from the past.
There always was some soul foolish enough to buy one and think they could avoid all the traps of stellar navigation and light speed in order to find some fabled lost planet of gold, treasure, or tech. There always was such. The galaxy seemed to breed them by the dozens. He wasn't that breed. He wasn't a scout or an explorer. He was a shooter. Always had been. He was a shooter even before he'd left his father's ranch on Stendhal's Bet. A shooter when he joined the militia. A shooter when he got sent to fight separatists on the southern continent, a nasty battlefront in a subarctic wasteland of ice plains, cruel mountains, and frozen seas. All of it on a forgotten world, a lost world. You can't find Stendhal's Bet on the maps anymore, the stellar charts. It's gone. Gone, baby, gone. That was 10 years ago. Just gone like that. Savages came one day, and they lost half the planet in a week. It had never been too populated to begin with. A colony world, a lot of ranching. Off-world beef exports had been the main source of business. But there had been a few big population centers. Hastings, Willoughby, Corazon. Gone by the end of the week. The militia had been deployed to protect the pop centers, and he went off to fight. Never mind the wife and baby, he went. Deployed first against the assault on Corazon along the eastern seaboard. They lost big time there, at Corazon. The savages had put down a pretty significant presence, like they were going to march across Stendhal's Bet reaping their booty no matter who stood in their way. There would be a fight. And that's all he'd ever asked for a fight, not fair nor good. Those things were for movies, but a fight. It's all he'd asked for. I mean, it wasn't all he'd ever asked for, but it's what he'd asked for ever since Stendhal's Bet ceased to be a place. Just a fight, within range, a good sight picture, and the chance to fight them and kill them. He'd asked for that ever since. Ever since the wife and baby. Those savages, the ones who had tried for Stendhal's Bet, they hadn't been calorie hunters like these on New Vega he watched through his high-powered scope from the 32nd floor of an apartment high-rise at the edge of Hilltop. Those savages on Stendhal's Bet had been metal scavengers. Anything that was metal, they'd hauled it off in their salvage vessels, back up to their big hulk to be taken off away and forever. That had been their booty, yeah. They were making something out there in the deep dark where hyperdrive ships from all the navies of the world wouldn't ever find them. During the worst days of the battle for Willoughby, when the wild man helped the fading defenses trying to retake the city, they found there was no city to retake. Nothing but a skeleton of that oldest of boom towns from back during the frontier days. Some said Willoughby was named for the navigator on the horizon. Stendhal was the captain. They came to the planet hundreds of years ago. Captain got to name the world as the old traditions went. So say the old-timers. But who would really know now? Less than 100 people survived the savage attack on that world 10 years ago. Survived the attack. And survived Tyrus Rex's reign of fire that cleansed the savages and everyone else from the planet. He didn't hold that against the crazed sociopath Tyrus Rex, the man all the worlds hated these days. He'd been there on Stendhal's Bet during those last days. There was nothing left, nothing but the savages in the end. Only a fool thought wife and baby, you know, might have. Only a fool. He didn't hold it against the war criminal. But sometimes he did. Because maybe wife and baby might have made it. Maybe the savages hadn't dealt with them in the way they dealt with everyone they found in Willoughby and Corazon and a dozen other one-horse ranching towns across the continent. The Trail of Blood. He'd stopped using their names. Now they were wife and baby. It was easier that way. Easier to package, easier to ruck, easier to carry. He didn't picture them much anymore. Unless you had a savage in his scope. The powerful and dialed-in scope that sat above the large-bore rifle he used. He didn't picture them then, either. Or at least, he didn't see them. But he felt them.
her standing just behind him, baby on her hip, and that smile he'd fallen in love with. The smile when he did things for her, things she couldn't do, things that made her proud he was her man. He could feel them in those moments, those first finger pad on the trigger moments, those slow breathing, falling, almost gone, pull, boom, thundered the weapon, moments. And way out there, right up close in his scope, another savage had a massive hole torn open in its chest. With his special rifle, he didn't need headshots. The big rifle could hit them anywhere and they were done, hell. If he hit them in the head, and sometimes he did, the head would just vape. But he preferred to nail them center mass in the upper portion of the chest, because for a moment they knew they were dying. They had at least a second, sometimes more, to know that they'd met the wrong survivor, that they'd met the wild man, and now they were dying because of him. And if you believed the rumors, the theories, the whispers that some spoke about the savages, no matter what tech tree they'd followed, all the old rumors said that these, in whatever form they'd become, these were as old as the hyperdrive itself. Older than that, if you understood your histories, from the way back. Once humans, no more. And now they were dying because he'd put them down. In those moments, you could feel her and baby behind him, smiling. Sometimes, he could almost hear her voice. "Another one, babe." That's what she'd say. He lived for that moment, when he could almost hear her saying that. "Another one, babe." After Stendhal got nuked into oblivion by Tyrus Rex, right down into zero viability for 100 years or more, because that was really the only way to deal with the savages, or so said those who believed in the renegade criminal known as Tyrus Rex, only way to be sure. He'd hunted savages ever since. He never would have left Stendhal, but he was wounded at Gap Springs, badly. Face and chest all scarred from a fragmentary device that went off close and suddenly just as everything went to hell for the militia. Next thing he knew, he was on board the Mercy, United World's hospital frigate. They were in jump. Stendhal had been dead for more than a week, the doctor told him. And the worlds were baying for Tyrus Rex's blood because there had to be another way to deal with the savages other than just nuking planets into oblivion. The planets called it a raid. Tyrus Rex called it a foothold, a prelude to a living, breathing world of savages. But who knows? Maybe they didn't desire those things anymore. Maybe they had moved beyond the wanting land, sky, and water, beyond the basic ken of a human understanding of those basic things. Maybe. In the darkness of the galaxy, who knew what was possible? And so, after leaving the refugee center on Sudlow, one of the Britannian colony worlds, the planet on which he'd been established as an official refugee, he'd gone hunting on his own, gone looking. Got had for an old rundown scout vessel called the Sweetwater Express. Belonged to some old scout who'd been dead nigh on 20 years. His daughter was more eager to unload it than she let on. She was more than happy to sell it to the wild man. By then, that's what folks had taken to calling him. Big, brawny, scars like tattoos. Big beard and cold dark eyes that seemed to burn for nothing but revenge. And something that could never come back. He never told them the story, but they guessed it all the same. Pains like that, like an open window in your heart, someone once said. Everybody can see in and see that you've been blown apart. Revenge. Revenge was enough. "Do another one, babe." "Yeah." "Sure thing, girl. Anything for you." And so, whenever the savages or the rumors of a savage infection, outbreak, invasion came over the galactic transcom, he fired up that old scout that shouldn't have even run and took off for parts unknown, flying on baling wire and prayers. He'd shoot him for as long as he could. But in the end, Tyrus Rex or someone else, one of his true believers from another planet, a colony too close to the infected world to take chances, would nuke the planet until it glowed and the atmosphere itself caught fire.
and then it was time to go. They always lost, never won. But sometimes the savages would up and leave on their own after they'd taken everything they'd come for in the first place. Lives, water, metal, food, tech. They'd be off once again into the big dark, before the exterminators showed, sailing between the stars in their massive sublight colony vessels that were the height of tech, back before the hyperdrive. And now, after all that contact and scavenging and stealing, maybe they were the height of tech again. Savages. Hard to believe they'd ever been the best and brightest humanity had to offer. Once, long ago, the dreamers, thinkers, builders. Or maybe that was just what they'd said about themselves to justify it all. Men and women of destiny. Because destiny needs justification. 6 weeks ago, he heard the rumor that the savages had come in and hit a sector giant, New Vega, a big player in the fledgling galactic scheme. New Vega. He checked the flight directives and found that the world had an off-limits advisory tag. Surest sign of savages. So he fired up the Sweetwater Express one last time, barely got her into orbit, barely coaxed her into jump, and practically flung himself at New Vega on a best-guess trajectory. It wasn't a crash, not even a crash landing, but the Sweetwater Express would never leap into the hyper ever again. So be it. This world was as good as any to die on, and he could shoot savages all day long here. There were more than enough of them, even now, even after all these weeks of hunting them and watching them come out like cowboys back on Stendhal to ride the herds of survivors back into the ship. He'd taken the occasional shot. Just one shot. Always just one shot. And then he'd watch, dialed in close on the scope as the targeted savage flung back its faceless helmet and died looking at the sky. Do another one, babe. And now he was watching them. Big fight shaping up. This wasn't Tyrus Rex. This was the Coalition of Worlds, or whatever they were calling themselves these days. Coming in fast to attack. And what? Drive off the savages? Annihilate the savages? Study them? Take what they learn for themselves? That was all. That was all like a sin to the wild man. You couldn't reason with savages, couldn't annihilate them, couldn't study them, couldn't even understand what they knew. Why? Why? Because they weren't human anymore. And you wouldn't, in fact, no decent person would, want to know what they knew, what they discovered out there in the big dark, dark knowledge never meant to be known. How do you know that? He didn't hear that voice much anymore. He liked to hear hers instead, almost a laugh in her voice. A lilt. Is that what they called it? I don't know. He whispered as he watched them through the scope. Watched them gathering for the big fight at the bottom of the hill. Three spears, three prongs, three elements of the coalition going straight into a hornet's nest of savages. They had no idea what they were walking into. He could have warned them, but he didn't have a comm, just the rifle. His personally loaded ammunition and some gear to survive on, crawl away with, and shoot another day by.